Today, Russian experts arrive in South Korea to review the conclusions of an international investigation which found North Korea responsible for the sinking of a South Korean Navy ship in March and for the death of 46 sailors. The incident is among the worst since the Korean War, and relations between the North and South may be as low as any time since the armistice. There's real concern that another provocation, a miscalculation, even an accident could easily get out of hand. If you have questions about the tense situation between the two Koreas, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Victor Cha is co-author of Nuclear North Korea, professor at Georgetown University, and joins us on the phone from his home in Washington. Nice to have you with us.
My pleasure, Neil.
There have been any number of terrible incidents, provocations by the North over the years. Is this one different?
I think it is different, Neil, for two reasons. One is that it looks to be a premeditated attack by a submarine against a South Korean patrol vessel. And second is it's the largest loss of life in a military-on-military interaction between the two countries, really since the end of the Korean War. There have been other terrorist acts that the North has propagated that have left more than 100 South Korean dead, but this was the first military-on-military large-scale attack since the end of the war.
Worse than the bombing that killed much of the South Korean cabinet?
Yes, that was in 1983, an assassination attempt against the Chun Doo-hwan government that killed half of the cabinet. President Chun escaped only because he was late for the ceremony during the state visit. But that was a terror. I mean, there's a difference here between terrorist attacks, and that and the one in 1987 were terrorist attacks, versus a premeditated military attack, which was what happened on March 26th.
And it raises questions. North Korea is an economic basket case. It has difficulties feeding its own people. It relies heavily, and has in the last few years, on South Korean aid to help feed its people. And, of course, now all of that aid and almost all contact has been cut off, which raises questions about why.
Well, that is a very good question. Why would the North undertake such an action if it knew that it would somehow lead to sanctions by a South Korean government on which it has been dependent? I mean, one of the reasons is, of course, that the current government in South Korea is not nearly as unconditional in its willingness to engage with the North Koreans and give them food and energy and trade as the last two Korean governments, who were more liberal. And for 10 years, the two countries operated under something called the Sunshine Policy, which was basically unconditional engagement by the South Korean government in the hopes of long-term reciprocity from the North. A new, more conservative government came into power in South Korea and said that they were interested in engagement, but not so unconditionally. That they were willing to do things to really help the North, and the conservative president in South Korea set out benchmarks in terms of the things they would be willing to do, but in return they wanted the North Koreans to denuclearize. And we haven't had much success on that front, and therefore the current government has not been as willing to provide assistance to the North. And therefore the North may be trying to coerce the South Korean government into giving them things, because they are trying to shake up the peace, a peace in which the South Koreans have much more invested than the North does.
Another factor that is new, of course, is what you just mentioned, nuclear. North Korea probably has, 5 to 8 nuclear devices?
Yeah, the public estimate is they may have somewhere between 5 to 8 nuclear devices based on plutonium that they have reprocessed from the reactor in Yongbyon, which has been the target for about 20 years of U.S. diplomacy, either bilaterally or through the six-party talks, to try to get the North to give up their nuclear weapons. So another potential explanation for this is that the North Koreans are feeling increasingly confident, rightly or wrongly, they are feeling increasingly confident that they are a nuclear weapon state, and therefore not vulnerable to retaliation by other parties, precisely because of their potential for a nuclear counterstrike. Now, I think many people would think that's the wrong strategic logic, but it's entirely plausible that a North Korean regime, as isolated as it is, might believe that they hold that advantage now.
Seoul, the South Korean capital, its economic heart as well as its political heart, is within range of North Korean artillery. It could be leveled within 30 minutes, probably, by the number of tubes, very conventional weapons pointed at it right now. Why does North Korea need an unconventional deterrent? Isn't this deterrent enough?
Neil, that's I think that's a very good observation, and I think you're absolutely right that for 60 years actually next month, North Korea will have been able to maintain the peace through a very conventional deterrent on their part, which are thousands of artillery tubes that sit literally within 10 minutes of Seoul, South Korea, population of 22 million, with over 100,000 American expats living there. They basically can hold Seoul hostage. And that has been their deterrent, which raises the question of why they continue to pursue nuclear weapons. If they do indeed feel insecure, and they still feel the need for nuclear weapons, that really says more about the regime and the sort of insecurities a regime of this nature faces than it does the external threat. Nobody wants to attack North Korea. The United States doesn't want to attack North Korea. The South Koreans don't want to attack North Korea. The Japanese don't want to. Nobody wants to attack North Korea, yet they feel this sense of insecurity in large part because of the type of leadership that you have in that country.
And that gets to another point. There, we think, is a moment of succession about to happen in North Korea. Son of Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, is believed to have had a stroke a couple of years ago and is grooming the path for his third son to succeed him in office.
That's right. That's what most experts believe, that they're in the process of some sort of transition. The North Korean leader, as you mentioned, is not healthy. And it looks like he has three sons, and the third of his sons, the youngest one, who is only in his late 20s, looks to be the one that's been anointed as the successor. So this, if it were to be successfully carried out, would be the third dynastic succession in North Korea. So something in terms of where we are in international relations and world politics is really quite anachronistic. And yet, because of the nature of the regime, it derives its legitimacy from continuing this family line of succession, ruling over a basically an impoverished and mismanaged country.
And in the past, during succession, the new ruler took provocative measures to prove to the military and to others, hey, I'm tough. I can stand up to our enemies.
That's right. I think we've had two leaders in North Korea up until this date. Since the end of World War II, the beginning of the Cold War, we've only had two leaders. The first one, Kim Il-sung, had his so-called communist revolutionary credentials largely because he fought against the Japanese during World War II when Japan occupied Korea, and therefore he came into power already with revolutionary credentials. His son, the successor, the current leader, really didn't have those sorts of revolutionary credentials and therefore associated himself with various acts of belligerence, terrorist acts, the kidnapping of Japanese nationals, the kidnapping of South Korean nationals and others. That was part of his rise to power, if you will. And it's potentially possible that the third son may be legitimizing his transition, acquiring his revolutionary credentials through the actions that we have just seen in terms of this submarine taking out this South Korean ship.
We're talking with Victor Cha, professor at Georgetown, co-author of Nuclear North Korea, senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And let's get Sandra on the line. Sandra's with us from Easton in Connecticut.
Yeah, hi. In the New York Times on Friday, at the end of the article, there's a reference to the government, North Korean government, elevated to hero status the six crewmen of the mini submarine that sank the South Korean ship. So my question is, how can they both deny this and at the same time hand out medals for doing it?
Yeah, that's a very good point, caller. I think there have been press reports that somebody had information about these crewmen being given, celebrated when they returned from this activity, and yet the government continues to deny that they had anything to do with that. If, you know, if that press report is correct, and, you know, probably, I mean, the New York Times wouldn't publish it unless it was. They had.
Unless it believed it to be, yes, but, you know.
Right. Then, you know, it just says more about the sort of regime that we're dealing with in the North. You know, one that clearly has, does not have peaceful intentions and is really revisionist oriented.
Let's go to Randy. Randy with us from Elkhart, Indiana.
I heard a press release that said that North Korea said that if South Korea retaliated against North Korea, there would be an escalation. And in my book, retaliation only happens when you've done something, along the same lines as the previous caller.
Right. Well, you know, that's what the North has said, and I think the South Korean government thus far has reacted in a very sort of moderated and careful fashion. I mean, you know, from a policy perspective, they're really trying to thread a needle here because they want to be tough enough in terms of a response so that the North will be deterred from doing this again, yet they don't want to be too tough so that they provoke a war because nobody wants a war to start again. So I think what the government has done in the South is responded with economic sanctions, calling for taking this issue to the UN Security Council, as well as enhanced U.S. and South Korean naval exercises in these areas that where the submarine attack occurred. So, yes, the North has claimed that they will retaliate against any retaliation by the South, but the South's reaction thus far has been diplomatic. I mean, people forget sanctions, economic sanctions, are a form of diplomacy, coercive diplomacy, but they're still a form of diplomacy. The South Koreans have not sought military actions in response.
Randy, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And the key to all of this, a lot of people say, and this is the point we always get to with North Korea, is China.
Yes, I think that's right. The Chinese are the only ones that really have any material leverage over North Korea. And thus far, the Chinese reaction has been weak, I think a little bit clumsy and completely out of line, out of step with the international community. You know, while you have a five-nation investigation team basically concluding after nearly 2 months of investigations that there's no other plausible explanation for this sinking of this ship than a North Korean torpedo. And these weren't just any countries. This is, you know, South Korea, the United States, Britain, Australia, Sweden. I mean, these were countries that sent over 90 experts to try to figure out what happened. And yet the Chinese response thus far has been really anachronistic, sort of out of the Cold War, where they're still trying to protect this little communist country, you know, based on the history of the Cold War.
Well,
which is really, it's really unfortunate.
They have interest in preserving the regime as a buffer state to some degree. They have interest in no disaster in North Korea because they don't want North Koreans flooding across the border. And, well, I guess we're going to see eventually how they are forced to respond to this at the Security Council when it comes up for a vote.
That's right. I think the South Koreans have made clear that they would like to take this issue to the Security Council, if anything, simply to get the Council to acknowledge that this was a clear violation of the 1953 peace armistice that stopped the fighting in Korea at the end of the Korean War. So,
as you mentioned,
Chinese, 60 years
ago. Victor Cha, thank you very much for your time today.
Sure, my pleasure.
Victor Cha, author of Nuclear North Korea, senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He joined us on the line from Washington. Tomorrow, we'll talk with Steve Clevenger about his book, America's First Warriors, Native Americans in Iraq. You can see some photographs from that book now. You can head over to the picture show at npr.org.